Thank you all parties for holding. At this time, we're ready to begin the conference call. I'd like to advise you will be in a listen-only mode for the call today. The conference today is also being recorded. Any parties with objections, disconnect at this time. With that said, I'll turn the call over to your initial speaker, Ms. Linda Feinberg. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you very much. I want to extend my heartiest welcome to all of you who have taken the time to call in today and to express the appreciation of all of NASD Dispute Resolution for all of the hard work that you do for us. We run the largest securities dispute resolution forum in the world, and we believe the best, and we could not do it without the work and the contributions that all of you make. Now, as some indication of that, over 1,500 of you have signed up today for this broadcast, which shows real dedication on your part to be part of the NASD Dispute Resolution Forum. Our format will be as follows. I will speak, hopefully briefly, about a number of the important initiatives that affect the forum and your role in that particularly, and then we will go forward with questions, many of which have been pre-submitted. Additionally, you've been advised as to how you can ask questions and submit those, and they will be passed on to me by my staff, hopefully with the answers. But in case they don't have the answers, I have all of NASD Dispute Resolution senior staff here to assist me today. As you all know, in addition to running the largest dispute resolution forum in the world for securities disputes, we administer our arbitrations and mediations out of five locations, Boca Raton, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C. One of our significant initiatives for the next 2 years, in which you will play a major part, is to expand the number of hearing locations to make the forum more accessible, particularly to investors. As many of you know, particularly those of you from New York who live in New Jersey, in October of 2003, we opened a hearing location in Newark, New Jersey. In December of 2003, we entered into a partnership with the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators, and we are now offering arbitration and mediation in London for those investors who would prefer to arbitrate abroad, who may be living abroad, and save the expense of traveling to the United States. In March, that is this month, before the month is over, we will be opening a new hearing location in Hartford, Connecticut. And by January 2005, we are committed to offering an arbitration site in each of the 50 states of the United States. We now have over 50 locations, but we don't have a location in each state. So by January 2005, we'll have a location in every state, combined with Puerto Rico and London and perhaps other parts of Western Europe, to make the forum much more accessible for investors. It will be as accessible in that sense as going to court would be. As you all know, we've had record growth over the last 3 years. Our filings have been up from 2001 with about 6,300. Last year, we capped an all-time high with almost 9,000 filings. And almost 40% of these cases actually go to hearing, which, of course, is where you come in. Last year, investors prevailed in approximately 54% of the cases that were heard by you. And in the simplified cases, customers were awarded damages in about 60% of the cases. One of our key initiatives in which you play an important role is to try and maintain or reduce the processing time from the time that a claim is served until an award is served. And we have done a number of things to try and curtail the time that it takes to have an arbitration go from cradle to grave, as they say. Last year, we were able to maintain a 14.6-month even with a huge case increase. This was only slightly more than in 2002. Of those cases that actually went through hearing, that took approximately 17.4 months, up from 16.5 months in 2002. That means that cases that went from service of claim to award were decided in less than a year and a half. And we believe that that's through your efforts to keep moving the cases, and we would urge that you continue to do that. On our end, we did a number of things that we can control in order to keep the cases moving. For one thing, we closed more cases last year than were filed, and we're on track this year to do the same. We've done a number of other things. We have reduced the waiting time for you to let us know in response to a staff call whether you can serve on a particular arbitration, and we now have a 7-day response time. We have a rule pending with the SEC, which, as you know, must approve all of our rules before they become effective, that will reduce the time for parties to pick a chair from 15 days to 5 days. And the reason we did this is that our statistics show that most parties don't agree upon a chair anyway, in which case we revert back to the selection process and pick the public arbitrator who had the highest rating on the selection process. In terms of what the staff can do, we have reduced from 30 days to 20 days the time that the staff takes to generate a list of arbitrators to be sent to the parties, and we have reduced from 42 days to 30 days the time for staff issuing awards. And, in fact, some of our awards are issued within 4 or 5 days. Another initiative is to continue to have a really good, diverse roster of arbitrators. Right now, there are approximately 8,000 of you who are on our arbitrator roster and about 900 mediators. We began this year a verification process. It was not retroactive, but for new arbitrators, where we charge them a modest fee of $80. All that does is cover our costs to verify their employment record, to verify the licenses, whether an accounting or a lawyer's license or any other kind, and to have both state and federal criminal records checked. We think this will provide parties with additional protection and enhance investor confidence in our forum. Another really important initiative that concerns arbitrators has to do with training. As many of you know, in June of last year, we rolled out the first online chairperson training course. You can sign up for that course. You have online access for an entire month. You get cues and tests during the process, and you can log on at any time of the day or night. In addition, this is our very first arbitrator call-in program. We will be doing others in the course of the year, and we are about to roll out mini training modules as soon as the SEC approves a rule filing whereby we will, for a very modest fee of $25, make online training on various subjects available to you, again, with the same kind of format where you will have access to the training for a month with access at any time of the day. These training modules, three of which have been prepared, will include arbitrator disclosure obligations, discovery is a second one, and a third one is on expungement. As many of you may know, effective April 12th, there will be a new rule for expunging records of associated persons, and we have a training module on that. Now, at the same time, we recognize that your hard work is rewarded with relatively small honoraria, and we are doing a few things to enhance this. First, we have a rule filing that will, again pending with the SEC, will pay an honoraria to each arbitrator on a panel if the hearing is postponed by the parties within 3 business days of the first scheduled hearing date. We recognize that this is not a very large recompense for times that you may have set aside, but we believe it's a first step to making parties much more aware of the fact that when they do postpone a case, it has repercussions for the arbitration panel. The other thing we are doing, and many of you have asked about this in your questions that you've submitted and in our focus groups around the country with arbitrators, have complained that motions are becoming much more time-consuming, and particularly with the increase in the numbers of motions being filed. We have under consideration a rule that will provide honoraria for for deciding motions. We're working with a committee which includes a number of neutrals on it to figure out which motions should receive the compensation, who should receive the compensation, and how those fees for your time will be allocated. Today, our main topic is discovery. As most of you know, the Discovery Guide became available in the fall of 1999 after 3 years of groups meeting to reach some kind of a consensus about what documents should be covered by the various guidelines. One of the major purposes of the guidelines was to expedite the arbitration process and to try and temper discovery abuse in the forum. In May of 2001, we did focus groups and a survey to evaluate the effect of the discovery guide and found that many arbitrators were using it and that it had, in fact, essentially enhanced the discovery process. Nevertheless, in our new revised customer code, which I'll explain in a moment, we have in the proposed code added the discovery guidelines to the revised code and more importantly, provided specifically for how discovery motions should be handled and for much stronger sanctions. As many of you know, we have just, by way of digression, rewritten the entire arbitration code into three parts, the part for investors, the part for mediation, and the part for intra-industry disputes. We filed that with the Securities and Exchange Commission this fall. None of our rules can be approved until the Securities and Exchange Commission puts them out for comment, receives comments to which we then respond. So we are now waiting for the Securities and Exchange Commission to put this revised code out for comment. So we believe, based on this kind of a schedule, that it will be sometime in 2005 when we finally have approval. And we will do extensive training for parties, for staff, and for arbitrators several months before the code will become effective. Now, one of the things that the revised code does is to enhance the sanctions available to you in the face of discovery abuse. But even without the new revised code, you have a lot of tools at your disposal to deal with discovery abuse by either party. And we have just reminded members and investor counsel, first in a notice to members on November 6th of 2003, and then in a notice to parties posted on our website in January of 2004 about discovery abuse and about their obligations to engage in fair discovery, not to use discovery as a harassment tool, and to provide the documents that are presumed to be discoverable under the guideline. In addition, in February of 2004, we published a piece on discovery abuse in the Neutral Corner online, which is available to all of you. Under the current code, Rule 10321A requires the parties to cooperate to the fullest extent practicable in the voluntary exchange of documents. Voluntary does not mean they can do this at their whim. Voluntary means that the parties must exchange documents, and they are to do so with as little interference from the arbitrators or from NASD staff. That is the party's obligation. Unfortunately, too many parties do not meet this obligation, and that's where you come in. And you have a range of sanctions available to you to deal with discovery abuse under current Rule 10305. Sanctions may include adverse inferences, assessment of fees, and if there's material and intentional noncompliance, arbitrators, the full panel of arbitrators, can even dismiss a claim with prejudice. Recently, arbitrators have essentially met the challenge and issued sanctions in a range of cases. In one case where a party intentionally concealed documents, the panel assessed the party over $10,000 in sanctions and awarded $2,500 in attorney's fees. In another case, a panel awarded over $7,000 due to a party's failure to cooperate, and in another case, the panel awarded $2,750 in attorney's fees as a sanction for failing to provide discoverable material. In addition, arbitrators may, at the end of a case, after they've issued an award, refer a member firm or an associated person to enforcement, which is a separate arm of NASD, to do an investigation into discovery abuse. And we encourage arbitrators to make referrals where the conduct is egregious and where appropriate. The referral should be in writing and should be specific. And as I said, the regulatory arm of NASD, which is a separate division, is now reviewing arbitrator referrals, and I have been advised that there are a number of enforcement cases in the pipeline relating to failure to provide discovery based on arbitrators' referrals. A couple of other things about discovery. As you all know, depositions are strongly discouraged in arbitration. This involves there are a number of reasons for this. Depositions would make arbitration longer and more costly. Two of the aims of arbitration is to provide more efficient, less costly relief, and it also would greatly advantage the party with the greater resources, which rarely is the investor. So we urge you to continue to discourage depositions and for the same reason to discourage interrogatories. Deposition should rarely be granted. The typical case where a deposition would be warranted would be where a party is ill or dying and there's a need to preserve the testimony, or where a critical witness is not within the subpoena power of the parties or the arbitrator and is not willing to travel to the arbitration site. That's the conclusion of my initial talking point. I will now go on to answer questions that you have previously submitted, and this is your opportunity also to call in with any other questions that you might have.
Ted? Ted?
Yes, ma'am, I do apologize. Any parties that have questions they'd like to submit, press star 1 on your touchtone phone. That's star 1 to submit any questions via the phones. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I will, in the interim, start with some of the pre-submitted questions. One arbitrator asked, what should the arbitrator consider in determining whether to grant a motion to compel document exchange? Primarily, there are two major factors that arbitrators should consider. One is whether the documents are relevant or likely to lead to relevant evidence for the hearing, and that should be weighed against the burden to the producing party. Each case, of course, however, is very fact-specific, and you need to consider the facts and circumstances of the particular case before you. Another arbitrator asked whether we would consider or whether we were contemplating issuing standardized discovery orders and sanction orders. We are not planning to do that at this time, although obviously if you all perceived a need, we would consider that. Cases are, as I said, very fact-specific, really requires arbitrators to tailor their discovery orders to the particular case. And that's true with sanctions as well, which is why we have not at this time issued such standardized discovery orders or standardized sanction orders. As I said, if there appears to be a need in the future, if you all perceive such a need, we would do so. We got a very interesting question from an arbitrator about what to do when an arbitrator asked the parties whether the parties have had a full and fair opportunity to present their positions at the close of the hearing, and one of the parties says no. What should the panel do? We recommend that the arbitrators ask the party on the record why the party believes that to be the case and elicit specifics on the record. We then recommend that the arbitrators, the panel, go into executive session to discuss the matter so that the full panel discusses it. If the panel believes that there may be a valid argument, the panel may want to consider a number of things, reopening the hearing for presentation of additional evidence or testimony, directing additional hearings, or asking for post-hearing submissions. If the panel believes that the party's argument lacks merit, the panel should state its reasons on the record as to why it believes the proceeding has been full and fair and that the parties have had a full and fair opportunity to present their positions. Again, we urge that you have this statement put on the record when you believe that to be the case. Another question asked about the authority for the chairperson to act alone in ruling on discovery disputes. And I would refer you here to Rule 10321E, which essentially gives the Director of Arbitration the authority to appoint a single member of the arbitration panel to decide unresolved issues under the rule. Now, in most cases, it is the chairperson who is the single arbitrator selected, although that's not always the case. The proposed rewrite of the code, which I had mentioned, will provide more explicitly for the appointment of the single arbitrator, generally the chairperson, to decide discovery-related motions. But the current code gives ample authority for the NASD forum to appoint a single arbitrator to decide those cases. Another arbitrator asked questioned the panel's not getting copies of discovery requests routinely that go between the parties, pointing out in the question that if that were to be the case, there would be a huge overload of documents going to the parties, but suggesting that sometimes it was difficult to decide requests to compel when the arbitrators did not have the copies of the request. We agree that arbitrators should not, as a general rule, receive all of the discovery requests and responses that are between the parties. You would get more paper than you could possibly find a place to put. One of our big problems is storage. And since our hope is that most of the time the parties will resolve these disputes amongst themselves, you don't need to be involved in that part of the process. When the parties cannot resolve them and move to compel discovery or raise objections before the arbitrators, then it's up to the parties in the first instance to decide what documents they should give to you based on their prior requests, or the arbitrators, of course, can sua sponte decide to request documents, either the underlying documents that have been disclosed or, more to the point, the requests and the responses that have given rise to a motion to compel or to objections. And again, under the code rewrite, when that becomes effective, the motions practice for this will be much more explicitly set out. But you clearly have the authority now to ask the parties for the documents when the motions come before you. Another question in the same vein, what can be done to avoid, and I quote the questioner, the mountains of papers submitted to NASD and the chairperson in discovery motions? Again, we would urge that it is really up to the arbitrators to try and control and expedite the discovery process. Arbitrators or the panel have a lot of authority to do a range of things to expedite this process and to try and control the discovery process. You can direct the parties to meet and confer before any discovery conference. In fact, you can require them to submit a statement saying that they had done that before they bring a dispute to you. You can request a summary from them on what has happened during the discovery period. You can ask the party to set forth reasons for any requests or motions to compel. And you should, and we urge you to use, the initial pre-hearing conference script, which lays out a lot of these directives. Most importantly, we urge you to take control of the process by being proactive and guiding the parties accordingly and using your sanctioning power when the parties do not comply with the discovery of which they are supposed to do in the forum. Another arbitrator asked whether we were contemplating either allowing or requiring taping of the conference calls. conference calls may be taped now. If the parties request it and the arbitrators agree, a conference call may be recorded. And this can be done through the phone services that we use. And the arbitrators can, of course, assess the cost to the parties if that's appropriate. We have a question that was just submitted by one of you. How is the arbitration panel to respond when the attorney is acting in defiance of the arbitration panel in regard to discovery? Can the panel sanction the representative? Yes, and we have had examples where the panel has sanctioned the attorney. One case, in fact, went up on appeal to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit upheld the panel's use of its sanctioning power against the attorney who was obstructing the discovery process. So, yes, you do have that authority to do that, and courts have upheld that authority. In line with the amount of time you spend on discovery motions, one of you asked about compensating arbitrators for their time in reviewing discovery motions. As I indicated earlier, we have set up a subcommittee of the NAMC. The NAMC, that's the acronym for the National Arbitration and Mediation Committee. As many of you know, a few years ago, NASD Dispute Resolution was spun off as a separate, wholly owned subsidiary of NASD, much in the way that RPO is. That's the Regulatory and Policy Operations, the better known as the Enforcement Regulatory Arm. And we have our own board of directors, which is overlaps with the NASD's board. As part of that board, we have a standing board committee called the National Arbitration and Mediation Committee. And that subcommittee, whose members are publicly available, their names on our website and in the NASD manual, consists of lawyers who represent brokerage firms, lawyers who represent investors, and two neutrals, one arbitrator and one mediator. And over half of the NAMC consists of public members, that is, people not affiliated with the industry. And we take most of our issues to the NAMC before we make rule change proposals to the board and then to the SEC. We have set up such a subcommittee now of the NAMC to explicitly consider motion practice and compensation to arbitrators for that motion practice. And we hope before the year is out to have some proposals to bring to our board and then to file with the SEC for comment and approval. So I know that you will all be happy to know that we are moving in that direction. Another question on discovery that one of you asked, should documentation be required to prove that parties made a good faith effort to procure documents? Arbitrators certainly have the ability to do that. Arbitrators may ask or require a non-producing party to provide an affidavit or a declaration stating that a good faith effort was made and, as importantly, to lay out what steps were taken to try and locate the document, where the search was made, what categories of people were contacted to try and determine whether the documents are available, whether those documents are in the control and custody of the non-producing party. And we urge you to require such an affidavit if you are not otherwise satisfied that the parties have made a good faith effort to produce documents. Another question going back to interrogatories and depositions. One of you asked whether we are considering allowing the parties to propound interrogatories and to have further use of depositions. Now, as I indicated earlier, depositions are very strongly discouraged in customer arbitration. The exceptions would be to preserve the testimony of an ill or dying witness, to accommodate critical witnesses who cannot make it to the hearing or are not otherwise subject to a subpoena. In some circumstances where all the parties have the resources, in large or complex cases, depositions actually might expedite the case rather than be a hindrance. And finally, sometimes there are very unusual situations, really only you can determine that on a case-by-case basis, that would warrant a departure from the general rule. Similarly with interrogatories, interrogatories are different from information requests. An information request, for example, might ask who the branch manager was or the supervisor of a named associated person. And those are certainly legitimate. Interrogatories go to try and figuring out the underlying theories of the case, the defenses that will be presented, and those, again, should rarely be granted. That would make arbitration too much like court, and we really are trying to have a more efficient, more streamlined process than what a litigant has in court. Again, one reason for this is that interrogatory practice, deposition practice, definitely advantages the parties with more resources, and we really want this to be an investor-friendly forum to make arbitration easily accessible to parties who have a legitimate claim. Another arbitrator asked whether we have any plans to modify or update the discovery guide, and you've asked that just at the right time. We have just set up a different subcommittee of the NAMC, which will review the current discovery guidelines and the current sanctions, which are both part of the guidelines and in our revised code, which is pending before the SEC. We're doing this for a number of reasons. One, there are lots of different kinds of cases now than there were 4 years ago when the discovery guide became effective. There were no cases at the time, or very few, relating to margin or relating to breakpoints and market timing or relating to analyst cases or research. Two reasons for our doing this now is we really do view discovery as one of the major deterrents to expediting cases, and we want to do everything we can to streamline these cases, and we want to make sure that arbitrators are fully aware of all the sanctions available to them to curb discovery abuse. So that's a project. Based on what happened last time, I do believe that project could take a couple of years. Last time we set up three different task forces in order to develop some consensus on what documents should be included in the guidelines. We're going to move the process faster this time, but it still will take a year or two. An excellent question from one of you that just came in. What can be done when one of the parties is using tactics to delay the hearing? Again, we believe arbitrators have the authority to take control of the hearing. Arbitrators can set hearing dates. If the parties have had sufficient time for discovery, the arbitrators can order that hearing dates be set at particular times and not let the hearing drag on for years and years. The parties can order sequential hearing dates. The parties can say to respondents from firms or law firms with many, many lawyers that it's not acceptable to assign one lawyer to hear many, many arbitrations and therefore be unavailable for 2 years for a hearing. So we believe that those are things that can be done by the arbitrators. Also, we believe that the arbitrators can be firm on a postponement request. It's up to the arbitrators to decide whether to grant those postponements in most situations, and we believe that you have the authority to deny those postponements. We were asked by one of you in the pre-submitted questions about the authority of an arbitrator to impose monetary penalties. And here we would refer you to Rule 10324 of the current code, which says that arbitrators are empowered to interpret and determine the applicability of all provisions under the code and take appropriate action to obtain compliance with any ruling by the arbitrators. Such interpretations and actions to obtain compliance shall be final and binding upon the parties. In addition, we would refer you to Section 8 of the Discovery Guide, which gives the panel the authority to issue sanctions if a party fails to produce documents or information required by a written order, unless the panel finds substantial justification for the failure. Now, again, you also, as we've indicated, have the authority to impose sanctions on, the panel may impose sanctions on a party for failing to comply with discovery orders. With respect to firms, brokerage firms, or associated persons, arbitrators have a further remedy available to them at the conclusion of a case after an award has been issued. Arbitrators can make a written referral to the regulatory enforcement arm of NASD about the conduct of a firm or an associated person that the arbitrators believe obstructed the discovery process or any other part of the arbitration process, and we encourage arbitrators to do that. Additionally, arbitrators have from time to time in the arbitration award itself spelled out conduct that the arbitrators believed was totally inappropriate in a customer arbitration forum, and have spelled that out in the award essentially as a deterrence to others who would engage in such tactics. Another question that you've just asked, which is foreshadows what we will be putting out for training, which deals with the expungent rule, and if we could give a brief synopsis of it. This is very high level. I would refer you to Notice to Members 04-16, which is on the website, and we will be putting out a training module. But in essence, in order to order an expungement, the arbitrators will have to make certain findings, and there are three specific findings set out in the expungement rule, one of which the arbitrators will have to make, such as that the allegations are factually impossible. For example, John Doe was named as the associated person of the XYZ firm when John Doe never worked at the XYZ firm, and in fact the party meant to name Jane Doe. That would be one example of the kind of case where you could give an expungement. If essentially the arbitrators find that there's absolutely no merit to the claims against an associated person, and there's specific language that the arbitrators have to invoke, the arbitrators can order an expungement. Upon ordering an expungement, the person who is the subject of that expungement order must take that award to court to get it confirmed and must notify the regulatory arm of NASD that it is doing so. The regulatory side of NASD will determine whether it believes the expungement is appropriate, since it is the regulatory records of NASD in all 50 states that would be expunged, to determine whether the expungement is appropriate. If NASD regulatory arm believes it's appropriate, then the party will go ahead with the court action. If the NASD does not believe it's appropriate, it will seek to intervene in the court action to address why it does not believe the matter should be expunged. Now, that's it in a nutshell, but as I said, we will be putting out a mini-training module that will go through all of this, and we will have information on our website as well. Another pre-submitted question. Are we contemplating, and I'm quoting, a very specific and blunt section on sanctions in the revised code as to exactly what is permissible? Yes, indeed, we are. And I've been avoiding quoting particular sections of the code rewrite since it's still pending for comment at the SEC. But since there seems to be a lot of questions about this, section 12211 of the pending code rewrite states very expressly the kinds of sanctions that arbitrators can issue, including assessing monetary penalties, precluding a party from presenting evidence, making an adverse inference, assessing postponement or forum fees, assessing attorney's fees, costs, and expenses. The revised code also says that the panel may initiate a disciplinary referral at the conclusion of an arbitration. Finally, a panel may dismiss a claim or a defense or an arbitration with prejudice as a sanction for material and intentional failure to comply with an order of the panel if prior warnings and prior sanctions have proven ineffective. As I've said, this is part of the Code Rewrite Project, which you can find on our website and which is pending at the SEC to be put out for comment by the SEC. I don't think I previously mentioned this, but our website is www.nasdadr.com, or more simply, you can access it from www.nasd.com by clicking on the tab, I believe it's on the top, that says Dispute Resolution. And you will find there our proposed code rewrite, which has been filed, as I said, in three sections with the SEC. Another question that's just come in from one of you, do we plan to issue guidance on how long after the IPHC, the merits hearing, should take place? Yes, indeed, we are looking at that very issue. We're going to seem very subcommittee heavy, I realize. We have still a third subcommittee of the NAMC looking at this very issue. It would be premature for me to discuss specific time frames, but we will be issuing specific guidance on this. If that doesn't help expedite, then we will propose a rule that would require the parties to be ready for hearing absent extraordinary circumstances within a certain time frame. Again, another question from one of you, questioning whether it's the role of the NASD or the role of the arbitrators to sanction NASD firms for failure to comply with this discovery guidelines. And our answer to that is both or either or. Now, as we've gone through, you have many options for sanctioning a party, and you can do that in the context of the arbitration proceeding. You also have the option at the end of a proceeding, after you've issued an award, to make a referral to the disciplinary arm of NASD. And at that point, it is clearly up to the regulatory arm of NASD to examine your referral. And all referrals get examined by the regulatory side of NASD. And as I mentioned, there are now a number of cases in the pipeline. We separate ourselves, so I'm not aware of precisely what those cases are or whom they may be against, but they are in the pipeline and will be initiated by NASD enforcement in the near future. Another question asked, which a very thoughtful question, will arbitrators appear biased against a party if they issue sanctions for noncompliance during the time that the panel is still hearing the case or considering discovery motions and has not yet issued an award? That's certainly a risk. We assume that you will all take into consideration the facts and circumstances of each case. You've all taken an oath to be fair, and that you will be even-handed. We believe this is no different from judges who frequently impose sanctions during a case where appropriate, and we believe that you have the same authority and should exercise that during a case, and that a court, if you are temperate and even-handed, will not vacate an arbitration award because you've issued sanctions during the course of a hearing. We've just been handed a question, one I was going to get to from a pre-submission, but a question about confidentiality orders. As you may well know, this has become a fairly controversial subject of late, with many parties asking for expansive confidentiality orders. Again, we will be putting out guidance. We're working on an article right now, which we will publish on our website and in the neutral corner, about confidentiality orders. I don't want to essentially foreshadow that completely, but we believe that the first line of battle would be to encourage the parties to enter into a stipulation, thereby keeping you out of the confidentiality issues. If the parties can't can agree to a stipulation on confidentiality, then we suggest you look at a range of factors. How broad is the confidentiality order being sought? Does it include every document that's being exchanged? We would suggest that in most cases that's probably too broad. Or does it just cover certain documents that really should be more appropriately be considered for confidentiality orders? I call to mind here someone's tax returns. As you know, the IRS has penalties for release of tax returns. We believe that that would be appropriate for a confidentiality order. Are there competing interests at stake that require confidential treatment of the proceedings? For example, trade secrets. That's another area where the law has certainly intervened to give protection, does it for federal documents under the Freedom of Information Act. We recognize, as I said, that this is controversial, and we will be providing guidance certainly within the next month or two. Another question that one of you just submitted, do we plan to compensate arbitrators for last-minute postponements due to settlement? Now, yes, as I indicated already, the $100 honorarium for postponements, if it's less than 3 days before the first scheduled hearing, applies to postponements for whatever reason, including settlement. We hope by this to encourage parties to settle earlier in the process, and arbitrators will have the ability when the postponement is made to allocate the cost of that. That essentially exhausts the questions that you pre-submitted. I have several more that have just been submitted by those of you on the line. Do we discourage requests for admissions? That's an excellent question. I didn't cover that when I talked about interrogatories and depositions. At this time, we neither encourage nor discourage requests for admissions. That's really up to the arbitrators. Admissions and stipulations of facts, of uncontested facts, would expedite the proceedings. If you believe that the requests are fair and reasonable and will expedite, you certainly might want to consider whether then they would be appropriate in that situation. Another excellent question, are attorney-client privilege questions in the authority of the arbitrator to decide? And the answer there is absolutely yes. Any privilege question may be raised, whether it's attorney-client, whether it's the spousal privilege. There are certain privileges that are peculiar to just certain states, such as the accountant's privilege or the religious privilege for conversations with your religious leader. In many of these situations that are less common, we would urge you to have the parties brief the issue if there is a contest about whether the privilege applies. But, yes, arbitrators have the same authority as judges do to decide those issues. Another question, how do arbitrators go about issuing their own subpoenas? My staff has suggested that here I should say talk to the NASD staff attorney, so I will suggest that. And the code also allows arbitrators to issue subpoenas. The subpoena form is on our website. Some of this may be subject to state law, so I can't give a pat answer on this. But we do urge you to talk to the NASD staff attorney or case administrator on your case, and again, to look at our website for the subpoena form. Well, that being the case, I guess they keep coming in. Okay. I was going to say goodbye, but we still have questions. If a claimant asks for customers' records of other customers of the brokers, is this an invasion of privacy? I believe you need to consider this on a case-by-case basis. There are a range of ways to deal with this. You could, if you were inclined to order that discovery, order it with the names of the customers and other identifying information deleted. You could require confidentiality. It really would depend on the nature of the case and whether you thought under the facts and circumstances of that case it was appropriate But again, as I indicated, records can be turned over with any issues relating to privacy, excluding that information, names, phone numbers, social security numbers. Again, similar as to what is done when state or federal governments get requests under the Freedom of Information Act. And again, you might ask the parties to brief the question as to how the privacy interests, whether they apply, and if so, how they will be protected. For any questions, we're putting these all on. We're going to post, or just new questions that come in. I'm being asked about Q&As on our website. We will be, in fact, posting any other Q&As that have come in from you, either pre-submission or on the phone that we don't get to, and they will be organized and posted all on our website. And it will be Ask NASD is what the way you'll get to it after you go onto our website, which, as I said, is nasdadr.com. And there's a button to push. My staff is telling me called Ask NASD, and you will be able to access all of the Q's and A's on our website, all the ones that have been submitted. Well, thank you so much for participating. Given the numbers of you who have participated, we certainly will do this again on another subject in addition to the one we've just done on discovery, and it's likely that we will do another one in about 3 months' time. So thank you so much for participating, and we look forward to any further questions that you have that you submit to us. With that, I will sign off.